Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are on paper 46, right at the beginning, which is on old single column, page 519. All right, so we're going to start out with some of the lay of the land in the very literal sense on Gerasim. It's going to seem a little bit like we're back in paper 42 talking about physics-like things. Not as intense, obviously, but they're going to give us some scientific facts and some basic geography of Gerasim. So let's just get into it here, and I'll comment on some intro things after we read that preface paragraph there.
Paper 46, the local system headquarters. Gerasim, the headquarters of Satania, is an average capital of a local system. And aside from numerous irregularities occasioned by the Lucifer Rebellion and the bestowal of Michael on Urantia, it is typical of similar spheres. Your local system has passed through some stormy experiences, but it is at present being administered most efficiently, and as the ages pass, the results of disharmony are being slowly but surely eradicated. Order and goodwill are being restored, and the conditions on Gerasim are more and more approaching the heavenly status of your traditions. For the system headquarters is truly the heaven visualized by the majority of 20th century religious believers.
Okay. Notice how in the middle there they use that expression, has passed through some stormy experiences. That should remind you of the coinage of the name for the local system, Satania. Remember, I've mentioned this before, they're using those IA suffix for the local system names that they coin because they want to use the parallel where nations like India, uses that IA suffix. So it's literally the nation of something or other. And remember, Satan in Hebrew is adversary. You're going, well, am I supposed to take that directly? Is it the nation of the adversary? That isn't ring true. Like they're just, if nothing else, what we just read. It's not the nation of the adversary, especially not, in the wake of Lucifer and now even Satan being interned and what they're saying here about things beginning to come back. We were reading about Laniforge and his crew. The proper literal sense is it's the nation of adversity, right? Stormy experiences. All right, so it's so we have the nation of adversity, and I should mention, I was saying the parallel. Remember, you have for the races on a world, that's parallel to clans, and then the world, the whole world, that's parallel to a tribe. And then the local system of those worlds, of those tribes, is parallel to a nation. And then the constellation of those nations is parallel to a territorial state where you're ruled by law. The legislative level is at the constellation level. So they're using that clan, tribe, nation, territorial state parallel. And that's why they're using the nation names for the local systems. Then what about Gerasim? What about the name that they, have selected for the actual headquarters world? Anyone who is on this planet, when they see that word, they go, well, that looks awfully similar to the word Jerusalem, doesn't it? All we're missing is an A-L, right? And we'd have Jerusalem. That's the whole point. They've just taken the name Jerusalem and they've thrown the A-L out just because you can, and you still have something you can pronounce. And all they want to do is leverage off of the first two verses of the 21st chapter of the book of Revelation, where, you know, in the first verse, remember how they talk about a new heaven and a new earth? And then they talk about the new Jerusalem in the second verse. All right, so here's the new Jerusalem, a new Jerusalem word. They just took the word Jerusalem and made a new word out of it, you know, because there's a lot of direct linkage between the vision of a quote-unquote New Jerusalem by John, you know, and Gerizim. So they're just trying to match those up. So that's all it's meant to mean, is just the quote-unquote New Jerusalem. And then what's the quote-unquote New Heaven? You know, they just construct a word that's kind of similar to the word heaven, Havona. That's the new heaven word. And what's the new earth word? Urantia. All right, so you have three words, see, for the new heaven, the new earth, and the new Jerusalem. Gerizim and Havona are you know, exceptions to the general rule that they are constructing some sort of a literal etymology. They're just, you know, playing with the words a little bit, and Havona has, you know, it reminds you of Haven, and things like that too. So it's all appropriate, but it's really just, you know, the quote unquote new heaven. Yep.
Well, I can't tell you how many times people who don't know their answer say, "Well, if you headquarters is called Satania, then, you know, this has got to be a book about Satan." I mean, why, they could have picked other words to use the same thing. And, mm-hmm. You know, to me, first of all, it's probably not called that when we get there.
Yeah, they're not speaking English anywhere. Right. None of these words are.
Right. For whatever. I mean, so that's my point. Mm-hmm. It's,
right.
But so, I don't know, it seems like, from my point of view, it's a lousy choice.
Right.
I
so
I understand what you're meaning is the etymology of what you're talking about, but they probably could have gotten the etymology.
Well,
so I know it's a tough question, but do you have an
no,
idea?
No,
of why
no, no. No, I can speak to that. I've answered that question. I've answered that question 50 times. Right. So the people in the webinar, he's just wondering. It's like, why on earth would the revelators select a word for the local system that is so loaded? First of all. You know, it's just like Jesus did with the parables. He constructed the parable so that those who wanted to reject him had an easy off-ramp. There was always a way that they could easily misinterpret the parable in a very negative way, and then just dismiss him out of hand. So part of it is it's a test. If you're still in the mode where, you know, you think that Satan is marauding, you know, and doing all sorts of ridiculous material things, I mean, this book isn't even remotely for you.
Well, that's not true.
Okay.
Because I was in that mode, and this book is definitely.
No, you weren't in that mode, or you wouldn't be here.
Well, yeah. Way back when.
Right. Okay. The whole point is you had a potential. Right, we're talking about. We're not talking about someone that's initially going to feel some tension with that, and then has the ability to come around and discover the truth of the revelation. Despite that, I mean, that's just one of countless things that would trip you up in this book. And if you can't recognize, if you don't get some reality response with the revelation. You know, there's all kinds of things. The word satania is the least of them that will cause you to fling it into the fire. Okay. You know, and it doesn't have to be literally, you know, you think it's of hell, so it should go literally back in the fire where it came from, right? But the other thing is, of all those Christians who are still thinking in a very literal sense about Satan, there's a subset of those Christians who know that lowercase s, A-T-A-N, is a Hebrew word. They're scholarly Christians. They know that that isn't a proper name of anyone. They know that that's a very modern thing where we took that, you know, where Christians took that Hebrew word adversary, like, you know, you're in a trial, a court trial, and the adversary is the Satan. I mean, it's not an evil word at all. It's just a simple word for adversary. Okay? And you took the word adversary, and you put a the in front of it, and you capitalized the A, and you said you're going to call the evil one the adversary. Okay? Well, which in Hebrew would be the Satan, and you'd capitalize the S. And then eventually you just like, well, drop the, and let's just pretend it's an actual name. Okay? If you're a scholarly Christian, you know all that. Just like you know that Christmas isn't actually on the 25th of December. You know, Jesus wasn't born on the 25th of December. You know, if you're a scholarly Christian, you know that. Right? So it's looking for someone who has that potential to engage it in a more enlightened way. On top of it all, you know, it is the case that they're going to also use Satan to name one of the bad guys, right? And so, you know, you've got that little reminder that in the place of adversity, there used to be, roaming all throughout the local system, the adversary, the actual adversarial individual. Which is not Lucifer. Was not, you know, the adversarial individual was not the system sovereign. You know, he just sort of sat there on his throne of the God of Liberty, you know, and sent Satan out, his first lieutenant, you know, to actually engage, to do the, you know, to be adversarial against the people in the local system. Right? So it all fits in very appropriately.
I have a follow-up. Okay. And I'm going to go back even further. So let's go back before Lucifer rebelled.
Right.
And, you know, which was probably billions of years of the original planets coming in, and he wasn't the adversary at that time.
Right.
And you're saying to yourself, well, it was still named Satania then, theoretically. I mean, it was always named...
Well, no, it wasn't. Satania. See, that's the thing.
But wait,
they're only naming it relative to telling us about it. Now...
Well, all I'm saying is my mind would go on and say, okay, if this is the name of our system, then it probably was that then. Okay, let me just finish my thought.
Okay. Yep.
And my thought would say, well, maybe it's because they do name them, you know, after, you know, the lieutenant or whatever it is, and you know, who's in charge, so on and so forth, and I, you know, I don't know. But for most of the time of the existence of Satania, or, you know, of Lucifer, it wasn't a bad situation.
Right.
It's just, half a million years or whatever, billion years.
Right. You've got to understand that none of the coinage is some sort of existential coinage. It's purely for the purposes of the revelation. Like, you're a proud creator son and created mother spirit, and you give birth to a Lenanadec son. Do you name him the entity that is entirely darkness?
Okay.
Do you name him Kalagastia? No, you don't. Right. Why do the revelators give him that name? It's like, that's not a valid name for him 300,000 years ago. It's only a valid name for him post the rebellion. Why is it so valid? Well, he's a planetary prince who went to darkness. What's the term that we use for the devil, you know, historically? The prince of darkness. Right? So we've got that term, the Prince of Darkness. Now, if the revelators are saying to themselves, okay, I've got this human expression, the Prince of Darkness. Should I apply that to the system sovereign, or should I apply that to the planetary prince? Seems to fit better with the planetary prince, since it's got the word prince in both of them. And so let's coin a name where we use the Latin for darkness, caleg. It's Latin for darkness. Let's just coin a name. And we're not going to give him a personal ending of IA. Right. See, we're gonna give him the non-personal ending of TIA. We're not even going to grant him personality status. We're gonna call him an entity now, you know, a non-personal thing, the entity that is entirely darkness. Yeah. The AS means entirely. Kalig, darkness. AS, entirely. TIA, the entity, you know, that is.
See, so in another million or 2 million years, they may change the name.
It's just like Nebadon. Okay, Nebadon doesn't, you know, like I explained this before, you know, just look at the literalness of that name. All these names, that name doesn't distinguish this local universe from any other local universe. For an ascender in a different local universe, their capital is also Nebadon, the local upland in the Milky Way galaxy. You know, the nebular upland is what it means, right? It's the first plateau. Right, that you reach as you're climbing in your ascension scheme, you get to this plateau. Right? Right? They're all named to just lend truth to the picture, or also to weave it into the evolutionary context that they're speaking to. That's the whole point. Again, it's not a disclosure of facts. The book is not a disclosure of facts. It's not the fifth epical disclosure. It's the fifth epical revelation. You don't reveal facts, you reveal truth.
There are some facts, but you're right.
Right, there are facts, you know, and coordinated essential knowledge. You know the expression, right? You got to coordinate the knowledge to a degree. But the point is to not disclose facts. Like, to disclose some transliteration of the local universe tongue name for the local system, that doesn't do us any good, right? Okay. You know? The whole point is to give you a word that you can feel some truth flowing through. Like there, and that segues exactly to the last thing they said in here, in this preface. For the system headquarters is truly, they say, the heaven visualized by the majority of 20th century religious believers. Okay. Now we're in a very short time, we're going to read, they're going to explain a little bit about the whole heaven and heaven of heavens things, ideas, and how those have been played out historically. And some people have used the seven heavens idea historically, and they say that was more directly tied to the seven mansion worlds. Various visions or disclosures by, you know, beings, celestials on the planet, that led people to a mythology of there being seven heavens, and that's what they tell you, that's factually, you know, not truthfully, but factually tied to the first seven mansion rules. And then they said there's other things that humans have rambled on about, where they've used the idea of seven heavens, where it's not tied to the seven mansion worlds. It goes from the mansion worlds all the way to paradise. The first seven mansion worlds are the first heaven. Gerasim's the second heaven. Constellation levels the third. The local universe headquarters in its worlds is the fourth. Eversa in its worlds is the fifth. Avona is the sixth, and paradise is the seventh. Okay. So those are the two different schemes where there's kind of some literal, factual linkage to using the heaven. So you go and go, wait a minute. This doesn't fit either of those, where this is sort of the, like, at least the first heaven, or, you know, so what do they mean, truly the heaven visualized? In a truer sense, when people have visualized heaven, the point of that visualization in their mind is, I've got this whole mark of the beast, quote unquote, I have this whole animal origin nature. You remember, that's another thing. You know, technically, the mark of beast has nothing to do with the devil or anything like that. That's just, the beasts are animals. You have an animal origin nature. It's like, well, how, you know, what domain of the universe of universes is about you starting with a full-on animal origin nature and then slowly transcending out of that? That's your initial world and the seven mansion worlds. That's the domain where you are being purged of your animal origin nature. So when you finally leave the last vestiges of that animal origin nature behind and go to heaven, right? Where are you? You're on Gerasim, right? That's what they mean by that, right? So in a truth sense, regardless of whatever foolishness someone might have in, you know, in their theology, their doctrines, or, you know, in terms of facts or so-called facts, what they're really thinking of is that, quote-unquote, heaven is a place where I've gotten beyond all of these things that are really problematic in my life right now. You know, my fear, my anger, my greed, you know, my hunger, my whatever. Right? All of these animal origin things. Right, so that's what they mean. And see how that fit into what we were just saying. You want... The words they coin are not coinages first of fact. They're coinages of truth. So find the truth of the word, and then see if there's also some factual things that you can bring into it as well. But do the, you know, find the truth first. Right? And and it, definitely when you're talking about the local system, you know, they can leverage off of a number of things that are in the book of Revelation from John's vision that actually made it through not completely corrupted. You know, like him seeing a class of students graduating from the seventh mansion world and coming to Gerasim. You know, and him talking about the heavenly city that's where they were arriving. You know, he was thinking they were arriving from Earth to heaven. They were actually going from the seventh mansion world to Gerasim. You know, but see that he had the truth there, even though he didn't have the facts. But he had the truth, and because he talks about them being purged of the beast, being purged of their animal origin nature. He saw, you know, his adjuster tried to give him the truth. And the adjuster basically did, but of course he interprets it in his limited factual context. So set aside his factual rationalization and see if you can see the thread of truth that was there. You know? And that's what the revelators are saying. Don't take anything in the book of Revelation literally, but you can look for threads of truth in it. And we're going to leverage off those threads of truth. And you had something earlier on.
It's just that the Nanadex cycle, it's a long cycle, but yeah. It's a cycle. So Lucifer wasn't always...
Lucifer and Satan were here, you know, only for a very short time. The local system was there long before...
So yeah. They wouldn't have named it after someone who wasn't going to even come along for...
Right. I mean, they didn't even know he was going to be the first lieutenant, you know, at the time that it was first named and... in the super universe and local universe tongues, right? See, so all those things, and you just, you know, and if you're only thinking factually, see, the more you think merely factually, the more you are going to reject the book. The more you start thinking like, well, that's just completely stupid. I mean, they tell you right in the book that Satan wasn't even, the first lieutenant at the time that the local system was formed. So whoever wrote this book couldn't even be consistent. And see, you know, you start with a false initial assumption, and you'll reach erroneous conclusions. You've got to pick the correct initial assumption. You can only conclude what you assume, and people don't know that in general. They think that their conclusions are somehow consequential. No, their conclusions don't mean anything. It's all predicated on your initial assumption. And where does that come from? You can't derive an initial assumption, you know, with deductive reasoning, right? How do you know what the correct initial assumption is so that when you get a conclusion, you don't just check to see, well, it matches the observation. It's like, well, yeah, you've probably constructed the rationalization scheme so it matched, the final answer matched the observation. So it's rational, but is it logical? If it doesn't have the correct initial assumption, it's not logical, even if it gets the correct answer. That's the thing. You know, and a scientist, a genuine scientist, is not just trying to find a rationalization of a material observation. He's trying to find the rationalization of a material observation, the one that is true. Because there's, you know, a really smart person can come up with 100 that are false that get the correct answer, but which one is true? Any of them? Right? That's what true science is supposed to be about. And the revelation of truth could obviously greatly help you with that. The authoritative elimination of error. Well, how do they authoritatively eliminate error? They give you the correct initial assumptions. And then they expect you to recognize them and produce new deductive reasonings from those initial assumptions and overthrow every rationalization in every field of endeavor of mankind with those new initial assumptions. That's the point. All right, let's get into some of the physical aspects.
One, physical aspects of Gerasim. Gerasim is divided into 1,000 latitudinal sectors and 10,000 longitudinal zones. The sphere has 7 major capitals and 70 minor administrative centers. The 7 sectional capitals are concerned with diverse activities, and the system sovereign is present in each at least once a year.
Okay. So you can see as you scan down, you've got all these little nugget paragraphs that they want you to sort of take one at a time here. Okay, so step one, remember what the size of Gerasim is. It's 100 times the diameter of the Earth, roughly. Remember how those work. The sub-satellites are about the size of the Earth. The major satellites are about 10 times the diameter, about the size of Jupiter. And the central worlds like Edentia or Gerasim are about 100 times the diameter of the Earth, about the size of the Sun. Okay, so we've got this world that's about 100 times the diameter. So its surface area is 10,000 times the surface area of the Earth. Right? So that should be in your head already as you start reading this. And so you're going along and you see that it's broken up into all of these latitudinal longitudinal things. Like, wow, those are big numbers. Well, not when you remember the size. 10,000 longitudinal zones. Oh, there's nothing random about that, is there? So each of those longitudinal sections, you know, between two bounding meridian lines, is roughly the same surface area as the Earth, you know, without any oceans. Okay, 10,000 Earth strips, you know, Earth-sized surface strips, you know, like a orange or grapefruit, you know, all the way around the world, you know, like the sections of a grape. You can see they call them, they talk about sectional capitals, you know, like grapefruit sections or orange sections. Okay, and then the parallels, the latitude lines, primary latitude lines, they're, so they have 1,000 latitudinal sectors. So in other words, they have 500 in the northern hemisphere and 500 in the southern hemisphere. You know, just starting with the equator and, you know, doing 500 of them, and the last one, you know, ends at the pole. Okay, so that they've got it broken up into all those latitudinal and longitudinal bins. So they have this. Underlying grid work that everything's going to fit into. Remember, these are architectural worlds, you know, so everything is, you know, is designed and constructed, and, you know, so, you know, they start with a framework, and it's everything that, so everything is going to be fit into this grid work of latitudinal and longitudinal bounding lines. Now, when they say the sphere has 7 major capitals and 70 minor administrative centers, You're going, well, how am I supposed to picture those visualized? Well, they give you a clue when they say the seven sectional capitals. It's like, oh, okay, so that must be going around. They're probably on the equator, and there's seven of them. They're probably, you know, underneath each major satellite. You know, you've got that string of pearls of the seven major satellites going around JRSM. There's probably, you know, one associated with each one. Remember how we saw there was coordination between the 70 major satellites around Edentia and the way it, you know, the world was broken up into 70 sections like that. So your first guess would be that you've got 70 of them. Seven of them around the equator, and those are the seven major capitals. Now, and if that's a proper interpretation, seems pretty likely. When they say there's 70 minor ones, I'm going, okay, it's probably, you probably have 35 in the northern hemisphere and 35 in the southern hemisphere, and you've got five sets of seven, see, in each hemisphere. So, you know, they're just going up, you know, some number of degrees up in latitude and putting seven more around and then up a little bit more and seven more around, like if you think in our terms of, you know, 90 degrees from equator to pole, you know, if you put one at 15, you know, five around at 15 degrees and five around at 30 degrees and five around at 45 and 60 and 75, right? You know, something like that.
Well, maybe not.
Yeah, maybe not. I mean, that
closeness of those when they get up.
Right. That, you know, they may not want them that close when they're far. You know, I mean, you can just, you know, it seems, you know, the fact that the numbers are so convenient like that, I mean, that would be your first guess. You know, that would be your working hypothesis, and then see if there is anything in the book that refutes that. But that's a good working hypothesis for the way they've laid these out. But still, that would be, you know, when you've got a you know, that huge circumference of that equator, just seven major capitals, they're a long ways apart. Okay, so. So that tells you something, that whatever sort of city-like structuring is on this world, it's, you know, the city centers are very, very separated from one another, so that you could have very distinct separate domains built around them. You know, the exurbs aren't overlapping, you know, with these city complexes, if you will. Okay, so that's giving you a little feel for the for how this is. It's not going to look like a Borg sphere where the entire thing is just one giant, you know, building, you know, covering the whole surface of the planet. Okay, all right. Let's see. I guess that's about all we have there. All right, let's keep going here.
The standard mile of JRSM is equivalent to about 7 Urantia miles. The standard weight, the gradient, is built up through the decimal system from the mature ultimaton and represents almost exactly 10 ounces of your weight. The Satania day equals 3 days of Urantia time, less 1 hour, 4 minutes, and 15 seconds, that being the time of the axial revolution of JRSM. The system year consists of 100 JRSM days. The time of the system is broadcast by the major chronodex.
Master
chronodex.
All right, so the master chronodex, remember the word chronodex, just literally means expression of time. Right? They are the expressions of time. They're the ones that broadcast the time, right? Express the time out into the universe of universes. Okay, so notice how they're saying, you know, think about the truth of your mile. You know, relatively big length that you have that you call a mile You know, why do you have a mile? I mean, why don't you use inches to describe how fast a car is going? You know, why did you pick this mile thing? You know, it's that you know, they're trying to tell you that there's a size like that on Gerasim, where the way a mile feels to you here, there, for a person to have kind of a similar experience to what you have in going the length of a mile, for them, it's about seven of those miles. Gives them a similar sort of experience of, well, there's a fairly goodly distance, okay? Right. Now, it is kind of fascinating that experiential size for them is about seven Urantia miles. Doesn't seem like a very random number. I don't know. That's just a curiosity that it seems to be about seven, not six, or, you know, or 4 3/4 or whatever. Okay, so there's that. You know, let's do the weight thing last. Let's do the time thing. It's a similar thing. You know, we have the concept of a day, the time it takes our world to go around once on its axis. They're saying that's used in general. There's a day on all the worlds on high because all those worlds are rotating on their axis. And so that's a very fundamental unit of time for them, the time it takes their world to rotate once. You know, and the time it takes for Gerasim to rotate once is different than the time it takes for Edentia to rotate once, etc.
What's the point of the rotation if there's no seasons or sun or anything like that?
Yeah, right. The physics of it all. Yes, I mean, there's a million things, but just take a simple thing about if you're spinning a top. Is it more stable when it's spinning definitively, or almost not spinning and wobbling all over the place? See, it gives it a stability, that axial revolution. That's one thing you can think of. Then there's all the other issues too, but. Everything, you know, has a naturalness to it. All of the objects in the universe of universes rotate like that because it's just a natural state for them to be in. Okay, but they've got the concept of one rotation, so that's a quote-unquote day. And then just whatever it is by design, I mean, there's obviously 100,000 things that I have no clue of that makes it so that they needed to make Gerasim to have a rotation time of what's, in our terms, 3 days less 1 hour, 4 minutes, and 15 seconds. And I'm sure if it was less 14 seconds, the whole thing would blow up, you know, or something. I mean, you know, there's something very precisely designed about it, you know, having that angular velocity.
Of course, you know,
whatever the heck it is. Then they've got, you know, in the same way that we would like a chunk of time that's some small multiple of days. You know, in ancient times, you know, we picked seven because seven times four was 28, and the month was about, you know, the time it took the moon to go around once was about 28, and so it was convenient. They're doing everything decimal system, but they're going to pick something in that same ballpark, you know. We picked the number seven because it's in the right ballpark. It's not three, it's not 19, it's something 10-like. There's a 10-like number of days that we want to call a bigger unit, a quote-unquote week. Okay, and so on all the different worlds, whatever the day is on that world, 10 of those days is a week. That bigger chunk of time where you do certain things in a day. Bigger projects take a week, right? And then there's also something that's what we call a year, the truth of a year. I mean, yes, our year is the time it takes the Earth to go around the sun once, but there's more to it than that. The more you study this, the more you recognize that it isn't just arbitrary which world is terraformed and inhabited by us. You know, and that coincidentally, the gravity here, the length of the year, you know, the length of the day, when they all kind of fit into the cosmic system. Right? And so they have a similar concept. It's like, okay, and then those really kind of big projects, they take a year. You know, and I don't want to say it takes so many big number of days. I'd like to use a smaller number instead of, you know, not have so many digits. So I pick a bigger unit. So they have a quote-unquote year, 100 days. They did purely decimal system, 10 and 100. Okay, so they have a day and a week and a year in truth. And you can see, you know, because their day is, you know, roughly three of our days, you take 3 times 100, you get 300 days. It's, you know, it's not that far off of 365. Right? It's precisely about 80%, right? About 0.8 of our year. So when they talk about Gerizim years, like the rebellion on Gerizim lasting for 2 years, you know, that's roughly two of our years. You can kind of just, you know, forget about the decimal place. All right, so Gerizim has got a kind of a similar thing happening to what we're used to in terms of days and years. Now, what about this idea of a standard weight? Okay, remember when we were reading papers 41 and 42, we talked about this. They're using the word weight, and they were obviously generalizing, because they aren't just thinking, you know, what's the force on this object, you know, at sea level, you know, on this planet, right? I mean, weight is technically, you know, an acceleration, a force sort of a phenomenon, the way we use it in science. You know, and mass is just how much stuff is there, right? But to say weight is to put it into a gravitational field and ask how much it's being pulled on, being drawn upon by that gravitational field, the way we think about gravity as a quote-unquote field. Okay. Now, remember we talked about this. What gravity is really an inward motion. Everything is a motion. Like you start with the outward motion of the force charge of space, and you make that first individuation from that force charge. You make an ultimaton. You know, this first measure of inwardness relative to that outwardness of the force charge. An ultimaton doesn't have any mass. Right? So they're not going to say that they have a standard mass. You don't have mass until you get, you know, into the electronic level a little bit. If you're going to build up some standard quantity unit, it needs to be transcendent of mass. It needs to be something more fundamental, something that just describes the amount of inwardness there, the amount of centering influence, the amount of inward motion that's there. And they come in, it comes in quantized form. There's a first smallest unit of that inwardness. See, and like I was saying, weight has to do with being, you know, related to gravity, that inwardness. See, so they generalize the word weight. That one is appropriately generalizable, and there's still some truth there. You wouldn't want to use the word mass in a generalized sense of this, because that would be just totally confusing. Yeah. So they take the word weight and they generalize it. So that even though something that doesn't have mass has a weight still, has an amount of inwardness. You take that one little smallest unit of that, quote-unquote, weight, and you build it up in steps. Okay, the word gradient, the root, grade, means steps, a step. Right? You start with the smallest quantity unit, the smallest quantum of this weight, and you build it up in steps. Right? And so if they're going to coin a word, you know, they're not going to just say, well, you know, the truth of your mile or the truth of your year or things like that. They want, you know, they don't want to take pound or something like that. They're going to have to coin something so that it isn't too confusing. So they just say, let's use the word gradient, you know, the number of steps of inwardness that are there, Right? How many units of inwardness are there? Grade ant. Just add the ant suffix to it to make it a noun. Okay, so that's what they've done, and they just build it up. You get 100 ultimatons, you have 100 units of that smallest amount of quote-unquote weight, and they keep building up to something that is, in practical contexts, is sort of useful to them. And you notice it ends up being something that's not that far from the size that we found to be kind of a reasonably practical macroscopic amount of weight, a pound. 16 ounces, right, a pound. They build it up, and theirs is in that same ballpark, about 10 ounces. Now, again, you're going, huh, almost exactly 10 ounces. And you're going, well, that's two in a row here. I mean, we had something in the ballpark of 7, and now we've got 10, and neither of those are very random numbers. I don't know what's going on there. I don't know if I'm supposed to read into something that or not, but it is kind of curious that, all of the kind of arbitrariness of what a pound is and breaking it into 16, subunits, half, to get a 16th of it. And that ends up being right into their decimal system thing of 10, I don't know, it's kind of curious. Anyway, there it is, for what it's worth. So that's what they've done. They're saying in the same way that you need something that gives some indication of how much stuff you got there, and how long things take, in kind of a small, medium, and large way, of time, day, week, year. And you need to say, if you're going to say, I'm going to go from this city to this city, this headquarters to this one, how many is it? You don't want to use centimeters or something, and have this great big 15-digit number, right? You pick a bigger unit, and so they pick this thing that's about 7 of our miles to indicate how far it is between two points in the topography. That's the topography sort of unit, the mile.
Of course, the whole world doesn't use mile or pound. Most of our world uses...
Right. Sure, right. But, the kilogram is this, the kilogram is the pound-like thing, right? And, the kilometer is the mile-like thing. I mean, you set up, when you set up that base 10 metric system, you notice that some multiples of 10 in the metric system are used more than others in common things. Which ones? The ones that are similar to the very evolutionary units that we developed. You need a mile-like length. Right? And you need a pound-like amount, So
why is it a mature ultimaton?
Okay, remember when in paper 42, when we were talking about ultimatonic and sub-ultimatonic, right? You've got that whole bit of forming an ultimaton where there's this initial sort of pre-inwardness, but once it's fully, formed by an associate transcendental master force organizer. That's what they mean, the mature one, the one that's finally fully formed and he can let go of it. Right? That amount of inwardness, which has a naturalness to it. Obviously, all of the things less than that are artificial. He has his hand on this thing, and is going from no inwardness to some first smallest amount, and everything in between, absentitely. So all of that is, there's nothing fundamental about all those points in between, that he's artificially, turning inward. Right, right. It's not quantized. All right. You have something to?
Do you think is this adjutant mind that gives us these, or is this the spirit?
Well, remember, adjutant mind is just a...
It's super adjutant mind that's giving us a sense of distance and weight.
So first of all, just in terms of thinking about it, sort of feeling these things, that's the mind, and everything, is cosmic mind at some level.
Okay.
Right? I mean, adjutant mind is just very downstepped cosmic mind. Right, so everyone in the whole hierarchy is kind of has the same mindal perspective. We're all using some, you know, level of cosmic mind. And we also are all bringing in sort of the spirit encirclement, giving you an insight and an objectivity about things. That obviously comes into play because subjectively you don't have any sense of objects being arranged in a spatial context, you know, where I'm here and that object is over there and there's so many feet between us through space. All of that is your objective logical overlay on the experiences. Okay? And everyone in the universe of universes is doing the same objective overlaying phenomenon. Okay? And you go, well, yeah, but a lot of these higher beings, I mean, you know, if you can go from point A to point B in 4.5 million times the speed of light, you know, what good is a unit like a mile? Okay? But again, remember, I mean, even if you've got beings that are doing fancy things like that, you still have, you know, all these architectural worlds have plants and animals and, you know, right, there's material things on all these worlds. They're material worlds. And so everything goes down to the same foundation that we're at eye level with. And so even though there's beings that aren't so at eye level with that stuff, it's all founded upon that foundation that we're experiencing right now. And so everyone has the same experience. You know, about yay big is a convenient unit, right? To think about... you know, an animal going from there to there, or a transport craft, you know, carrying a material son and daughter going from there to there, or whatever.
Yeah. So if it takes the same amount of time for a sphere this big, up to a year for it to...
Oh.
Does that mean it's going a lot faster?
Yeah. I'll bring that up right now, yeah. So that's one thing to think about. So does anyone know what the velocity... is in miles per hour of, you know, if you're on the equator of the Earth, you know, how fast you're going on that tangential velocity, you know, takes 24 hours to go around one time, right? You know, if you just calculate how many miles it is around the equator, right? Yeah, it's just a little bit more than 1,000 miles an hour, yeah, right? So when you're standing on the equator, you're going about 1,000 miles an hour, right, as you're going around with the Earth. Obviously, this is only, you know, the day is not that much longer. It's only, you know, three times longer. But the world is 100 times the diameter. Yeah. So they're going more than 35,000 miles an hour, right, when you're standing on that equator going around relative to the stars, say, you know.
They can't see the stars, though.
Sure they can. At night when they dim the lights.
They only dim them to what it is on a full moon, right?
Right. You can see stars in the full moon, right?
Maybe,
yeah.
So in other words, stars must be going.
Right. So things are moving, yeah. Yeah, but see, it's going a lot faster.
It's really spinning.
Right. Yeah. You know, more than 30 times faster. Yeah. All right.
The energy of Gerasim is superbly controlled and circulates about the sphere in the zone channels, which are directly fed from the energy charges of space and expertly administered by the master physical controllers. The natural resistance to the passage of these energies through the physical channels of conduction yields the heat required for the production of the equable temperature of Gerasim. The full light temperature is maintained at about 70 degrees Fahrenheit, while during the period of light recession, it falls to a little lower than 50 degrees.
Okay, so you can see how this is all very, you know, familiar sorts of ranges of things. And remember that when you read about the inhabited worlds, this is not surprising because of the whole spectrum of variations of different physical properties of worlds. Our planet is kind of in the middle of all those different variations, temperature, gravity, whatnot, variations. And so the architectural worlds where everyone has to come together to one place has to be in the middle, right? So that, you know, the super breathers and the sub breathers and, you know, and the high gravity and the low gravity and whatnot, they all have a, you know, a relative happy medium that they're going to. So you see, I mean, 70 to 50, you know, 20 degrees like that, I mean, you know, that is indeed an equable temperature, a not very varying temperature. I mean, that's basically the same sort of year-round variation that you have on the Hawaiian Islands, you know, where you have all of that marine climate, you know, keeping the temperature from varying that much, all that water inertia. You know, the only difference is it's probably, you know, more like 85 to 65 year-round in Hawaii, but it's the same, you know, 15-degree offset, but, you know, about the same range. And so the kind of thing we think is idyllic, you know, that little bit of range and roughly the same ballpark temperature, you know, it's basically room temperature, right, during the day. So, yeah, that's because material sons and daughters are living on these worlds of nothing else, and material daughters are just like material females. You females can understand that, right? If they set the thermostat to 65 instead of 70, would you be comfortable there? No. Any more than human females are comfortable in, you know, over-conditioned office buildings and stuff, right? Right, I mean, everything is going to be what we expect for comfort. So then...
Of course, a different body, so...
Yeah, but not the material sons and daughters, just like us.
Well, yeah. Maybe different.
And the animals, and, you know, I mean, the material animals there have to be comfortable at the same temperatures that we're familiar with, right? It's all going to be, you know, very reasonable from our perspective. You know, and now a skeptical person would say, well, here's a simple example of how some human just made up all this crap. I mean, and not a very imaginative one. I mean, he just picks all the things that, you know, guess what? The temperature goes from 70 to 50. Wow, that's imaginative. You know, I mean, yeah. It's because they're looking at it from the wrong in the wrong way. Now, the one thing that if you're thinking in terms of the relationship of your concepts of physics to the relationship of your concepts of heaven, you know in physics that we've discovered that you can conduct electricity without resistance. You know, you have superconductivity. And that all seems very heaven-like, to have zero resistance. So when you're reading this and you're going, what? you know, that they literally heat these worlds because the conductors that are conducting this energy have resistance and get hot and radiate like my baseboard radiator? That's lit, yeah. Right. This is not magic physics. This is the same old physics that, you know, we're familiar with. You know, basically, I mean, it's translated into different energy systems and conductors and whatnot. It's not electricity and copper wires, but it all works in the same analogous way. You know, and so literally that seemingly unheaven-like thing of resistance where we try to imagine, boy, I wish there was some way we could build, you know, power transmission lines, you know, with less resistance. You know, wouldn't that be more idyllic, more heaven-like, you know, if we didn't have to, you know, and we try to make light bulbs, you know, so they have less resistance, so they don't have so much heat, and
all
these sorts of things. But see, just
billions for.
Notice how this challenges, you know. I mean, so resistance is not the mark of the beast.
It's futile.
It's resistance is futile. But that's the Borg world, and remember, we already determined this wasn't the Borg home world.
Competing for terrestrial.
Right, but you just see what's going on here. They're trying to get you to recognize that the things of the material domain are not, you know, somehow benighted or even evil or whatnot. You know, it depends on how radical you get in your theology about, you know, being anti-material. No, these are material worlds, and they use the same physics we do. That's God's physics. It's divine physics. It works on architectural worlds just as well as it can work here. Right? So that's, you know, they're trying to get you to get rid of these mystical ideas of heaven. It's a literal place. They literally use resistance heaters.
Okay? We couldn't have any of these machines without resistors that operate very precisely.
Right. Yeah. I mean, definitely when we got to electronics, you know, we started to appreciate resistance, you know, more. How it's not just a problem, you know, in a system, but it's a solution to many problems, right? See, here it is again. It's a solution to this problem. It's the solution that the master physical controllers use.
Yeah, but they get it directly from the energy charge from
space. Right, sure.
We haven't figured that one out yet.
Right, we haven't figured that out. Because again, you know, they're using sub-electronic and stuff that we can't manipulate. But
well, I just think since we're having this conversation, I was listening to the paper ahead of time, and we're talking about soil. You know, where the Sporinasia are licking their hands with the soil.
Right.
And I just don't see an architectural planet
that having dirt.
Same way. Yeah, it must be really similar to this.
Right. It's exactly like this. They have dirt. Right.
But they have
plants grow in dirt.
But I like the trees growing here aren't going to be the same there.
Right, things will be a little different, but still, same idea, right? I mean, you can take the shrub of a dentia, and you can plant it here.
Right,
move it here. Right, it's just, you know.
Shrub of a dentia.
And it's heated, so there's heat loss. There's heat being radiated out
into space, right?
This is supposed to be heaven. Shouldn't there be a way to conserve that?
No, preserve that. Right. Yeah. Somehow it should be just this magical existential place. No, it's an evolutionary domain. And the second law of thermodynamics still operates there. Right. And right. So all these things to try to get you to think about a literal, material, quote-unquote, heaven. Even the Isle of Paradise is dirt.
Really fancy.
When you stand on it. The fanciest dirt on in the universe of universes, even outside of the universe of universes. But it's still terra firma, right? Right? You plant your feet in matter, not in magic.
Dang.
All right. Okay, so just the other one little thing. So they've got, notice they call them zone channels. So it looks like the initial primary thing, you know, notice how they called them longitudinal zones up there? So it looks like the initial foundation of the grid is, you know, to send it around the planet and then branching off from there. So the main trunk lines are apparently going, latitudinally. Yeah, and then they're branching off from that. Okay.
The lighting system of Gerasim should not be so difficult for you to comprehend. There are no days and nights, no seasons of heat and cold. The power transformers maintain 100,000 centers from which rarefied energies are projected upward through the planetary atmosphere, undergoing certain changes until they reach the electric air ceiling of the sphere. And then these energies are reflected back and down as a gentle sifting and even light of about the intensity of Urantia sunlight when the sun is shining overhead at 10 o'clock in the morning.
Okay, just as pleasant, you know, as you can imagine, obviously, see? Nothing stark, all very soft and pleasant. Okay, so now look at, again, how literal all this is and how familiar all this is. Okay, now, again, you're kind of speculating. You go, okay, they maintain 100,000 centers. You know, your first thought is, well, there's 10,000 longitudinal sections. You know, is it just, you know, 10 in each you know, 10 different latitudes in each longitudinal, you know, section maybe, you know. So they've got all these generators, you know, that are beaming energy up into the atmosphere. And they're going up to, sure enough, an ionosphere. Yeah. JERISM has an ionosphere, just like we do. Right? The electric air sealing. Right? Everything, all the physics is still the same. Why do we have an ionosphere? Because there is ionizing photons impacting the upper atmosphere. In our case, you know, most of that's from the sun, obviously. You know, those ultraviolet and X-ray and whatnot, you know, energies that have enough energy to ionize an atom, those photons are, you know, relatively high energy photons are impacting the upper atmosphere of JERISM and ionizing just like they do this one. So there's an ionosphere, you know, so you could take your AM radio to JERISM and, you know, and you have an AM broadcast station bouncing it off the ionosphere and you could hear it on the other side of the planet, and it, just like here. Okay, just like here. Right, so they're going to use that ionosphere as you know, an encompassing source for this ground illumination. So they stimulate the ionosphere and get it to glow the light they want back down. You know, it's gentle, it's sifting. What do they mean by sifting? That means the light is scattering,
yeah,
right, through the atmosphere, just like ours. So remember, this is, you know, predominantly nitrogen atmosphere. So they're going to have a blue sky, just like we do, because of the scattering of the light, you know, by the nitrogen. It's going to be a very familiar sky. All right, so this very gentle sifting, even light, is going to then illuminate everything. And obviously it's not going to, there's not going to be that orb in the sky like we have, you know, where you got to look away from it, you know. It's going to be pleasant like it is when you turn away from the sun everywhere. It's going to be this nice even lighting everywhere.
Yeah. Wouldn't there be actually more energy transmitted out into space than gets reflected back?
I bet you they're really clever at hitting resonances so that it's absorbed and re-emitted, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. And you notice they said reflected. See.
Yeah.
Right. So they're doing it in a very clever way, so that just like the way our, you know, they're trying to get you to think of the way, you know, radio waves, you know, reflect back, right? And that they're doing a similar thing, so that it's not going through, you know, or being re-radiated outward. You know, mostly it's being, you know, radiated downward.
Yeah. If we were someplace, it states that if we were close,
we're about to read that.
Oh,
yep.
Yeah. Then you couldn't see it. So it
coming up very soon. Yep. You'll see. It's the next paragraph. Okay. Let's see. So did I get everything there? I think I did, didn't I? Yeah. Other than just we kind of mentioned this before. See, no days and nights, because there isn't a close star like our sun, right? So that is as JERISM rotates, there's a day and night, and you know they don't. They aren't going around the sun like we are, you know, tilt with their axis tilted and having seasons and all that sort of stuff, you know. So, there's none of that sort of variation that's the result of rotating and orbiting about a nearby star. You know, this system of 57 worlds is just sitting out there by itself. Right.
Which means that their time of day is the same sphere-wide.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so they don't have all of that.
Time zones.
Right, right. The whole sphere is, you know, is illuminated equally, you know, at a given time. There's no variation with longitude or anything like that.
So to get a period,
it's like one great big room with fluorescent lighting.
Well, so what are we going to talk about? We can't talk about the weather.
Yeah, and they don't have football there.
There's no
No weather, no football.
Yeah. They don't have football. Yeah. I bet they have something like that.
They will when Katie gets there.
I hate to break it to you, but you're going to talk philosophy.
What do you think the point of soil on paradise is?
To grow stuff.
Why would you need it?
You'd stand someplace.
Again, you know,
I thought it was
it's going to be, you know, an amazing organic place.
I'm just trying to picture, though, the purpose of dirt on paradise. If we're...
Well, I mean, when I'm saying...
need sustenance.
Okay, when I'm saying dirt, you know, I just mean in the sense I stand on the ground. I stand on, you know, I mean, you're not standing on a hardwood floor on paradise. You know, some paradisiacal linoleum, you know. I mean, it's earth. There's a ground. Okay.
But it must be a substance consistent with what's...
Right. It's absolutum, right? I mean, absolutely. Remember, it's, you know, it's completely beyond our comprehension what it is. But remember, it's, you know, when you look at absolutum, you don't see dead dirt. You know, they tell you it's just as... animated, living-like, is when you look at the body of the eternal sun.
Yeah.
So it's pretty fancy dirt.
Yeah, very fancy.
Right, I'm dirt in quotes here, right?
Yeah.
Okay, but it's important to not think of it as some mystical substance. Oh, it's matter.
Yeah, it's matter.
It's matter. Right? It's not a spiritual plane or something. It's a literal material object, right, that you stand on.
Yeah.
That's the whole point.
I would have been so let down when I got there, thinking it was going to be big and, you know, huge. And I see. That's great, though. That's exactly what we need.
I mean, it's, again... Remember, like I was saying, a skeptic would go, see, look at how unimaginative. Whoever wrote this, they just took all the things we know of and falsely exalted them. It's just an anthropomorphic universe of universes that these people have spun. It's like, no. No, the source is there. We are like what's on high because we're a downstepped expression of what's on high. What's on high isn't a false delusional exaltation of us. We're a downstepped expression of them. Everything, I mean, if there's dirt here, there has to be a source of dirt at an absolute level. Right? Or dirt wouldn't exist, right? There has to be an absolute source for all these things that we experience. Otherwise, they don't exist. Yeah, so, all right, keep going.
Under such conditions of lighting, the light rays do not seem to come from one place. They just sift out of the sky, emanating equally from all space directions. This light is very similar to natural sunlight, except that it contains very much less heat. Thus, it will be recognized that such headquarters worlds are not luminous in space. If Gerasim were very near Urantia, it would not be visible.
Right. So, they aren't, you know, an artificial star, right? I mean... Yes, I mean, you know, if you were not too far from it, you could detect it. But, you know, if you're orbiting the Earth on the night side, you can, you know, from low Earth orbit, you can see the cities, you know, lit up on the surface of the Earth. But if you go very far away from the Earth, you're not going to see any of that, you know. So it's not going to be seen from any great distance. This is not giving off that much radiation of any sort.
The sun's in the area, so it would stand out like a sore thumb.
Right. I mean, if there was a nearby star, you know, that so it was reflecting starlight, okay, then, you know, like we can see the moon, you know, reflecting sunlight, you know,
very different.
But they're not close enough to really, you know, be something that is a light or heat source or anything, you know, as we'll read here at the end of this section. Okay. All right, so, yeah, like I was saying, there it is in the next paragraph about how it wouldn't be visible if it was nearby.
It was close.
But again, see, you know, notice, remember, these are artificial worlds, so it literally is, you know, going to be, in a way, like a big outdoor room, you know, when you're in it. The whole surface is like being in a room with a ceiling, you know, where there's lighting coming from the ceiling. And it's, you know, more fluorescent-like, you know, lighting than it is sun or incandescent-like lighting, because there's not very much infrared. So they're not sending up something, so you have a whole bunch of infrared light, you know, hitting everything and heating everything up. You know, in the same way, if you put an incandescent bulb in a, you know, in like one of these track fixtures above us here, you know, that incandescent bulb is giving out a lot of infrared, you know, and it makes that fixture very hot. Right? But you stick a fluorescent in it, it's not really giving off any infrared, you know, and you can sit there on for a long time, you can grab all the fixtures, it's not hot at all. Right? It's the same thing here. So they're limiting it to the visible range without having a whole bunch of, you know, inappropriate infrared light.
Even more appropriate was an LED. Very
low. Yeah, right. Okay. So, right. It's like LEDs, like neon fluorescent, you know, those sorts of things. Those sorts of artificial things where you are very much limiting the range of frequencies that are involved in what you're doing, so that you only have what you want. Okay. Let's see. What else? Oh yeah. So there aren't any stark shadows. See, I mean, the only place you'd have a shadow is like, you know, underneath some sort of a horizontal thing, you know. I mean, obviously there would be some shadow underneath that a little bit, but, you know, even then, you know, there's going to be light coming from all the sides. So you're not going to have any really stark shadows anywhere on this planet. It's all going to be very evenly lit, you know, even more than this room is, you know, because instead of having just a few lights, you know, it'd be like having all the whole ceiling, you know, having a uniform illumination to it, you know, and there would be almost no shadows in this room, right? That's what it's going to be like there. A very, what we consider, artificial environment.
Yeah. Maybe indoors is there.
Right, obviously you go indoors and, yeah, right, you're out of the light, right? But just, you know, notice, you know, that they're trying to, you know, they get you to stop thinking about it as some sort of a mystical spiritual plane, and it doesn't have any literalness to it. It gets you to think about it literally, but then, I'm going to think about it like, you know, like I'm walking in the, you know, the mountains or something on this planet. It's like, no, you know, it's a very artificial domain. And the first thing that's going to strike you that way is the illumination. You know, going to be much more like inside of a building that we're familiar with. All right, let's see. But just, you know, see, again, it's very similar to natural sunlight. See, again, I mean, all of the inhabited worlds are populated by creatures that Adam and Eve's offspring on that world mate with. You know, all of this is very closely knit, right? So everything is going to be, going to have some naturalness to it in that way, right? It's not going to seem, even though it's artificial, it won't seem foreign, I guess, maybe is a way to say it.
Weird.
Right? Really weird or something. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
The gases which reflect this light energy from the Gerasim upper ionosphere back to the ground are very similar to those in the Urantia upper air belts, which are concerned with the aurora phenomena of your so-called northern lights, although these are produced by different causes. On Urantia, it is this same gas shield which prevents the escape of the terrestrial broadcast waves, reflecting them earthward when they strike this gas belt in their direct outward flight. In this way, broadcasts are held near the surface as they journey through the air around your world.
Right, so we already brought up that obviously that's, you know, what the parallel is.
So how do we communicate on the moon now?
Walkie-talkie. Radio waves will go in a straight line between point A and point B. You know, ones that don't reflect off of the ionosphere as well, like, you know, the higher frequencies, like when you get to the FM, you know, you can't hear FM in general as far as an AM or shortwave, because, you know, they tend not to reflect as well. You know, so they just go out to space. So you have to have a more of a straight line shot to an FM radio tower in order to hear it. You know, you can't expect to get it indirectly off the ionosphere. It's the same thing. I mean, you don't need any air for a radio wave to transmit.
That's why I only have one bar at my house.
Right? All right.
They use AM. That means all Marantia.
Okay, let's see if I can get it back here. Okay, so notice, I mean, the things are just throwing in passing and don't give you any explanation, you know, further explanation. They didn't just allude to ionosphere. They actually said it here now. And they even said upper ionosphere. So they're pointing out that they, you know, they at least have, you know, an upper and lower, you know, which is the main differential we have in our ionosphere too. An F layer and an E layer, as they're called, and that again has to do with some of that ionizing radiation penetrates further before it ionizes something, and so you get a lower layer. So you see the same physics. They're just kind of reminded that the same physics that we observe here is happening there. You got this: you know, photons are photons, and atoms are atoms, and you know it all works the same way. Let's see, anything else there? Mentioning aurora, you know, we certainly know that kind of illumination like that of light coming from excited or ionized atoms. But, you know, they threw in, although these are produced by different causes, the aurora are produced by actual particles striking the atoms, like mostly electrons and some protons, you know, that are coming in the solar wind and slamming against the atmosphere and ionizing things, as opposed to photons. You know, they're not, so they're just reminding you, these generators that they're beaming up, they aren't like beaming electrons or something up into the atmosphere. They're doing some sort of fancy sub-electronic or who knows what they're doing. But, so they're just reminding you to don't think of it as, you know, that they have giant BB guns, you know, they're firing particles up into the atmosphere. It's not an electronic, you know, crude electronic level bullet phenomenon like that, like the auroras are.
The sliding of the sphere is uniformly maintained for 75% of the Gerasim day. And then there is a gradual recession, until at the time of minimum illumination, the light is about that of your full moon on a clear night. This is the quiet hour for all Gerasim. Only the broadcast receiving stations are in operation during this period of rest and rehabilitation.
We'll read more about the broadcast receiving stations in later in the paper here. They're giving you some little facts here. So you've got this daytime, quote-unquote, illumination for 75%, and then they throw in the little indirect expression here. This is the quiet hour, okay? And you're going, well, okay, am I supposed to think of it literally? Are we talking about a Urantia hour? Do they have some sort of a Gerasim hour? No, I think they're wanting you to think, not so much factually, but truthfully. Okay, so think about, for us to say a quiet hour, you know, an expression we use, a quiet hour, what fraction of a day is an hour? 1/24th, you know, about 5%. Okay? So that would be my first, hypothesis. Is that you've got 75%, you know, at the even illumination, and then you've got 10% and 10% on each end of gradation, and then 5%, you know, where it's at the lowest illumination uniformly. That would be my, that's probably what it is, something like that.
Sleep.
So that it's in truth an hour. It's effectively, you get that fraction of respite time, right? Of just kind of downtime, of rest and rehabilitation. And of course, Adam and Eve have to sleep, and the material animals on the planet have to sleep. And, there's lots of things that have to sleep there. Even if angels and whatnot don't have to sleep, right? or Morantia beings or whatnot. But there's also, everyone is doing various regeneration things and whatnot too, even if they aren't literally, going quasi-unconscious and sleeping, right? Rest and rehabilitation, right? You plug in the power cord and get yourself charged up again if you're a spirit being and your batteries are getting low.
I kind of like sleeping.
Okay. So you won't have that, we'll be leaving behind that sort of really, deep checking out like we do now, but you still have downtime. Okay, so that would be that's my working hypothesis to begin with about how to interpret quiet hour, quote unquote. All right, let's see what else they say here. And why don't you read both of those together?
Gerasim receives faint light from several nearby suns, a sort of brilliant starlight, but it is not dependent on them. Worlds like Gerasim are not subject to the vicissitudes of sun disturbances. Neither are they confronted with the problem of a cooling or dying sun. The seven transitional study worlds and their 49 satellites are heated, lighted, energized, and watered by the Gerasim technique.
We'll talk about watered in a minute here. Okay, you see how they're explaining, the basic issue. You can't have any of these architectural worlds that close to any star. If any of these very artificially maintained, equitable environments, were close to an evolutionary star, they're subject to all the variations of that star, the vicissitudes.
Right? Or some being would have to step in.
Right, which would be, why do that? Why put it next to the star and then have to have power controllers constantly shielding you from it? Why don't you just build it away from the thing, right? And that's what they do.
Stars move, though, too.
Right, and there's all that issue, too. They've got to move stars around and whatnot, and they're moving around, these things are built away from all those issues.
Chris, are they built before the stars?
No.
Sometimes?
No, the stars are all basically here. Remember, all of the basic... Right, but they were built, remember the...
For each...
They rough out the local universe, and then the crater sun picks it, and... Okay. All of the basic matter of stars and whatnot are already there, and the crater sun, crater mother spirit didn't have anything to do with bringing that into... That's in bigger hands. That's master architect stuff. It's above their pay grade. They don't have a big enough picture to be able to deal with those issues. They don't know the big picture. They're God, but they're not, a high enough God. All right, so your first thought is, wouldn't it be really cool if they were like right in the midst of a whole bunch of cool stars or something? It's like, no. Right. I mean, it may be the case that, way off is... maybe they're close enough that they look more like Venus in the sky, than Cirrus or something, right? But they've got to be far enough away where there's no big issues, And of course they're going to have to be dealing with they can't have one of these architectural worlds anywhere near some star that's going to go supernova or something like that. So either they, would keep those stars away from any of the architectural worlds, or they would, prevent them from going supernova or whatever. I mean, they would, they have to, keep this as a very safe bubble environment around these things.
I like their description. I mean, that super starlight sounds like a good nighttime sky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so it also adds to the fact that, you know, that if it's not a super dark sky, you could see some things. But if you really wanted to get a good view, you got to go off world, right?
Yeah, the star students couldn't.
Right. Now, the one exception, remember, to an architectural system being close to a quote-unquote star is if it's an artificial star. The seven headquarters of the super universes, like Uversa and its surrounding worlds, they're built next to, we don't know the exact arrangement, but they're built next to this artificial star that gives off light without heat. Do you remember that?
No.
That was something they mentioned way back when we read about that. So that's the one exception. Those headquarters are close to a quote-unquote star, but it's not a natural evolutionary star. It's like the first circuit of Avona being close to the sun's world, the eternal sun's worlds, giving off light without heat. That's the kind of thing there. So that's the one exception. But you don't have to worry about vicissitudes and whatnot. See, with one of those artificial stars. Okay, I'm sure we're not going to get all the way through this section, but let's get into a little bit here. Some more about the physical issues here with these worlds.
Section 2, physical features of Gerasim. On Gerasim, you will miss the rugged mountain ranges of Urantia and other evolved worlds, since there are neither earthquakes nor rainfalls. But you will enjoy the beauteous highlands and other unique variations of topography and landscape. Enormous areas of Gerasim are preserved in a quote-unquote natural state, and the grandeur of such districts is quite beyond the powers of human imagination.
Okay, right, so if it isn't obvious already, they're artificial worlds, so you don't have continental drift or plate tectonics or erosion, or anything like that. No oceans, no rainfall. Like I said, it's like being indoors to a degree. I mean, that's why you don't need roofs, right?
Mosquitoes.
And we sure hope there's no mosquitoes there. Let's see. Okay, but it is beautiful, and then. You notice what they did there. Enormous areas of Gerasim are preserved in a quote-unquote natural state. Right? Because, of course, nothing is natural. It's purely artificial. Every plant, every animal, everything is artistically arranged by the celestial artisans. The whole thing is an art form. Right?
And what they're saying, basically, is it's not managed. It's
right.
Just natural.
Well, no. What? No, it's all managed. Every blade of every grass is managed. Okay. What does it mean to be quote unquote natural? They mean it's not like the Borg homeworld, like we were saying. It's not covered in buildings. There are areas where there's just plants and animals and whatnot. Right. Instead of, factories and office complexes and homes and right.
You think plants grow?
Yes.
Sure.
Yeah. We're about to read about that. Okay. So.
No animal fighting or killing.
We're going to get to that too. Everyone wants to jump ahead. We're all going to get there. Just breathe slowly. Okay. One thing at a time. It's just. There's a quote-unquote naturalness, but it's an artificial naturalness. Right? You want to re-emphasize that last line. So even when you're talking about this quote-unquote natural state, it's like, I can probably extrapolate what I know and imagine walking through those places and enjoying. No. And the grandeur of such districts is quite beyond the powers of human imagination.
Okay.
Right? I keep stressing that, and it's like, are you sure, Chris? Are you sure that it's really that beyond? Yes, they keep saying it over and over. Even the most, natural, played with stuff is completely beyond our imagination. We can't even imagine watching animals walking around plants. They're about to tell us, if we do that, what word describes what we were picturing in our head. Grotesque. Okay. It's just, there's, in some way, we've experienced a downstepped expression of what's up there. But it is downstepped. Okay? We can't even remotely extrapolate to what it's going to feel like to be even in a natural setting there, let alone an artificial, what we would more think of as an artificial setting. It's completely beyond our imagination.
So before you go,
yep.
So let's, when we get to, when a planet gets to its seventh stage of light and life, for instance, and we're able to, we might, this world might become somewhat like that.
Yeah. You're jumping ahead again. That there's a spot where they refer to that. Yep. Yeah. Exactly. See, but that's great thinking. That's great thinking. See, and that's one of the things that you should, before they tell you that, you should be putting the logical pieces together. It's like, what does that mean about this world? Like, especially fifth stage of light and life and beyond.
Right. We can do things with energy.
Is this planet going to be natural, right? In the way we think of that word anymore? No. It'll be quote-unquote natural, but, right? The planet, people begin to take over the planet, just like they manage it there. They manage every blade of grass there.
Yeah, they may not even need a sun.
The universe is mind-made and personality-managed. Period. Everything. Right? Every pebble, every blade of grass, every atom, every insect, when all is said and done.
There are thousands upon thousands of small lakes, but no raging rivers nor expansive oceans. There is no rainfall, neither storms nor blizzards on any of the architectural worlds. But there is the daily precipitation of the condensation of moisture during the time of lowest temperature attending the light recession. The dew point is higher on a 3-gas world than on a 2-gas planet like Urantia. The physical plant life and the Urantia world of living things both require moisture, but this is largely supplied by the subsoil system of circulation, which extends all over the sphere, even up to the very tops of the highlands. This water system is not entirely subsurface, for there are many canals interconnecting the sparkling lakes of Gerasim.
Okay, so you do have lakes, but they're just nodes in a canal system, which is above surface, water pipes. Okay, so it's like a building, that has plumbing, running through the floor, and stuff. Okay, it's a very artificial place. But all the physics is still working. So even though you don't have rainfall and obviously storms or blizzards or anything like that, you do, like you were wondering, see, if there's subsoil system, that means there's soil. And there's water, right? It's the same way. They're plants. They need soil, and they need water, and they need light, right? Everything is just as you would expect. And then they throw in that little bit of physics there about the dew point.
Yeah.
Okay, so remember it's 70, and then they lower it to 50 degrees Fahrenheit. And it's like, well, that's not very cool. But they're reminding you, even lowering it to just 50, the dew point is higher, so you don't have to cool it as far to get water to condense. And the dew point temperature, is closer to 70 on a 3-gas world than it is on a 2-gas world. The relative humidity is higher there, so the dew point is higher. Okay, so just that, all of those things that we the way we describe how that works, same thing's going on there. You have a certain, fraction of water vapor in the air, and if you're moving the temperature up and down, you can get that to condense. Okay, but you're not getting clouds and rain and stuff. It's controlled so that that doesn't happen. But they are allowing some moisture to condense on the surface. So, you know, that reminds you, if you have open houses, it's like, well, I better not have a sheet of paper laying on my desk in my house because it's going to get kind of all crinkled up every night when the the dew precipitates on it. It gives you some understanding of yes, it's all artificial, but it's there's a naturalness, obviously, to it. I mean, you know, with everything open like that, you wouldn't want to have this Urantia book sitting on your desk up there, right? So.
Because the dew sprinkle the page.
Yeah, it would get wet every day as the dew condenses on it, yes. What was that?
It's hard to undo.
Right, you'd have to have books and things that can exist. Right? Yeah. And if there's stuff that... Right. If there's stuff that can't withstand this kind of natural environment, there's going to have to be buildings that are sealed, you know, and stuff for doing some things, obviously. But just, if you were starting to feel a little bit like, boy, I mean, I'm going to feel like I'm locked in some institutional building with fluorescent lighting for the rest of my life. No. Right, does that sound like heaven? Right, see, so... Okay, but you notice they don't spell that out. They want you to put those pieces together as you reflect on what they say. Let's see, anything else there? We're about to mention the three gas thing, so I don't want to bring that up yet. Let's see, I think we got everything there, didn't we? Thousands upon thousands of small lakes. Maybe it's all Minnesota. And boy, do they have mosquitoes in Minnesota.
You can look at it the other way, too. When you look at the comparison of our planet to here, we live on a wild and crazy world.
Yeah.
I mean, not just us, but where we live is so incredibly primitive compared
to this. Yeah. So take the genuine truth, beauty, and goodness of what we have here, and it will be expressed in perfection up there without all of the unfortunate side issues. Yeah. All right.
The atmosphere of Gerasim is a three-gas mixture. This air is very similar to that of Urantia with the addition of a gas adapted to the respiration of the Urantia order of life. This third gas in no way unfits the air for the respiration of animals or plants of the material orders.
I see, you're about to explain that more. You've got plants and animals of material nature. And remember, they're just letting you to put the pieces together. What's this third gas? It's Urantia oxygen. Right, you've got material nitrogen and material oxygen and Urantia oxygen. Right? You're going to have because that third gas, it's not like the little bit of argon, say, that we have in our air or something, or carbon dioxide or something. I mean, it's a significant addition, and that's what alters the pressure and the dew point and stuff like they're talking about there. So you've got this major additional gas in the atmosphere, Urantia, oxygen, and you see, you're noticing again, they're talking about how the Urantia issues are involved with especially water. Okay, but at the same time, having Urantia oxygen in the air doesn't make it so that I'm going to, suffocate or something, or be poisoned. You know, and in no way unfits the air for me to breathe it right now. Okay, so like we said, there's some mysteries exactly how the Marantia and the material interplay that I can't, you know, explain to you. But anyway, it's there. All right.
I just
wondered, one thing.
How do they escape formation of fog? We're going to be hovering at the dew point
most of
the time.
I was going to ask that.
All right. Yeah, see, all these issues of clouds and fog and rain. And see, I mean, the fact that it seems like, well, how could they avoid that? That should just remind you, no, this is being very definitively micromanaged by those power beings. Yeah. They're present, ubiquitously throughout the environment of these worlds, So within their body presence, they can manipulate atoms as they wish and stuff. Yeah.
It appears to me that probably during this quiet hour, the mist would come to a certain level and then sort of be gone by the time we start moving around. Although if we walk around, probably get a little moisture on our booties.
Right, you would, yeah.
If
you were walking around barefoot and you stepped on a nice flat rock, you could slip and hit your head and right. But anyway, they just let us kind of imagine, even though they're basically saying even if there is quote unquote fog, it's quite beyond the powers of human imagination what fog would be like there, even. See, they're trying to just explain that it's all these things are somehow very transcendent in the way it would behave and stuff. Because I'm not going to say, see, it's almost like you would be observing stuff inside a being, right? I mean, it would be so intimate with personality management, right? So, it wouldn't have the fog sloshing around in the marsh sort of character to it, see?
Swamp gas.
Yeah, so.
Swamp gas. No.
Okay.
The transportation system is allied with the circulatory streams of energy movement. These main energy currents being located at 10-mile intervals. By adjustment of physical mechanisms, material beings of the planet can proceed at a pace varying from 200 to 500 miles per hour. The transport birds fly at about 100 miles an hour.
Forgot about that.
It's pretty cool.
The air mechanisms of the material suns travel around 500 miles per hour. Material and early Marantia beings must utilize these mechanical means of transport, but spirit personalities proceed by liaison with the superior forces and spirit sources of energy.
Okay, there's quite a bit there, so let's step through that. Okay, so you start, remember how it appeared that the trunk lines, if you will, for the energy circulation were latitudinal. So, and you can apparently couple into these lines of energy for electrified tracks or whatever, for a train. They can couple into this energy for mechanical devices to go along these lines. And so you'd have these main lines that could get you around, and then there must be some sort of grid branching off of them so that they end up with 10-mile intervals. And the fact that that's 10, okay, that would be 10 of their standard miles. So that'd be 70 Urantia mile intervals. But when they start talking about miles per hour for these, okay, that would be our miles per hour. They're giving it, in our velocity terms, So you think about transport birds, right? So in other words, those transport birds can do kind of what you would expect a bird to be able to max out at, at flapping or gliding speed. If you study birds on the planet here, birds can go faster if they're, diving and things like that. They can get up to, 250 miles an hour if they're going in a dive, some of them. But But, you know, you take something like a swift or something, you know, flying and gliding, you know, so you know, they can go at, you know, up in that 100 sort of max speed that you'd expect. And then the devices that are locking onto the power grid, you know, go from 2 to 500, and then their aerial vehicles, their planes, quote unquote, or what do you want to call them, are about 500. You notice they're both topping out about 500. It's like, well, why would that be? You know, why not 1,000? Yeah. Well, again, you don't want things breaking the sound barrier, right? So everything is, you know, obviously kept well under the sound barrier, so you don't have shock waves, you know, and whatnot disrupting. It's just a reminder of how controlled this environment is. You can't have all of these shock waves, sonic booms, and whatnot going on. So, you know, right? So it's all sub Mach 1, right? Everything that they're doing there of a material nature. You know, but that, you know, the fact of that is, you know, if you're maxing out at 500 miles an hour, that's a big world. So, you know, it's going to take you a while to get very far.
To go from one of those headquarters to the others could take
a long time. Right. Okay,
so
and
do you think the system cyber travels on those two?
No, that's the last thing. We'll talk about that in a second here. All right, so, you know, if you're just talking about kind of how limited the material, and, you know, notice if you're an early Marantia being, you still have to get into a material or whatever that you want to call these craft, you know. You have distinct limitations. You can't, you know, you don't have ubiquity, right? I mean, you're localized, you know, you're in your part of the world, and, you know, it's a big journey in a covered wagon to go, you know, way over to that other place on the planet, right? You know, you have to, you know, so it has, you know, it's going to have a culture that has a localized feel like that, right? There'll be a flavor around, you know, one of those major centers that will be distinctly different than the flavor around another center, right? Right, it'll have a local quality to it, right? At least in terms of what's going on with the material and the lower morontial beings. But like you were saying, when you go to the higher spirit beings, they've got some sort of a spirit energy grid thing set up here too, which they never explain much about the spirit energy stuff. So spirit beings are able to lock onto that grid and navigate it in some way, and I'm sure they can move it, you know, higher speeds, because you don't have to worry about sonic booms and stuff with them, right? Right.
In their miles per hour, it's like 71 miles per hour at 500 of our miles per hour. just to help you out there.
Right.
Takes a long time.
Right. Yeah. So it's a slow thing, you know. It's a slowness of you know. In terms of subjectively for them, yeah, very much. Yep.
Well, and there's at least, even if they never have accidents there, there's still the potential, because these are material things.
Yep.
So they have, everything has to be finely controlled.
Yeah.
Well, a lot like our control to the vehicles that are coming down the pipe now, you know, where you don't have to drive anymore. You just get on the thing and the car's
gone. Right. They're going to have very advanced technologies. They'll mention, you know, in a little bit here. But it all, you know, just notice that it's all very grounded. You know, much more grounded than your initial visions of heaven, you know, would picture. You know, especially when, you know, the transport birds is like, wow. You know, we're talking Lord of the Rings, you know, or Hobbit or something here. Getting on the back of a big, you know, or Avatar, you know, getting on the back of a big golden eagle, you know.
Yeah, you can't go much more than 100, you blow right off.
Right, I mean, again, you know, the physics of a bird flying. I mean, they can't go much faster than that, you know, right? Yeah, and, you know, plus they're carrying one or two, you know, adults, and, you know, so that's going to slow them down too.
Resistance thing again.
Right, there's air resistance and all that stuff, right? So
futile to go faster than I.
So that's just good to you.
All right, let's read a little bit more here.
Yeah.
Gerasim and its associated worlds are endowed with the 10 standard divisions, a physical life characteristic of the architectural spheres of Nebadon. And since there is no organic evolution on Gerasim, there are no conflicting forms of life, no struggle for existence, no survival of the fittest. Rather, is there a creative adaptation which foreshadows the beauty, the harmony, and the perfection of the eternal worlds of the central and divine universe. And in all this creative perfection, there is the most amazing intermingling of physical and morontial life, artistically contrasted by the celestial artisans and their fellows.
I see. So there's the statement, like I was saying. I mean, everything is being very managed by the celestial artisans. You know, what the animals are doing, where the animals are, how they're interacting with the plants, everything is all of symphony. You know, the whole world sings, like we talked about when we went to the celestial artisans paper. Another reason why it'll be just, it's so beyond your imagination, yeah. You know. And the whole thing is playing, like transcendent music. Okay, do you remember maybe when we were reading about the constellation level, you have these 10 different divisions of life. Three of them are animal-like from our perspective. Three of them are plant-like from our perspective. And then the four in the middle are beyond our our imagination. Right, so you've got this whole spectrum from very, very animal-like things from our perspective to very, very plant-like things and everything in between. All needing water and light and, you know, and whatnot. But what you were logically projecting there, John, a while ago. See, here it is right here, about how, and since there is no organic evolution on Gerasim, there is no conflicting forms of life, no struggles for existence, no survival of the fittest. You know, and how they're designed to be, you know, patterned after the central universe. And worlds are being evolved towards being like architectural worlds, which are like the central universe, right? So that's why you say you project forward in time, especially if you get to the fifth stage of light and life and beyond. This is much more like an architectural world. So there are no conflicting forms of life on this planet anymore. Okay, well, that's the end of all carnivores. Yeah. I mean, you know, you're left even wondering. It's like, well, I mean, what about animals eating plants willy nilly? I mean, you know, the goats eating the garden. You know, I mean, it starts to be really beyond your imagination. How does this work? Yeah. You know, when it doesn't have that normal ecosystem sort of interplay and give and take. Yeah, see, we have a hard time imagining what this is like. Yeah. You know. So you're not going to have Venus fly traps, you know, I mean, it's just anything like this. How does this all work exactly?
Birds eating worms.
Birds eating worms. Look, well, how does this work? I mean, you know, what do...
I miss that.
I don't want to go too far, but it leaves you in kind of a quandary, you know, it's like, well, exactly how does feeding and whatnot work? I'm not quite sure. But just note that. So, again... You know, I've said this many times, when we get deep in light and life, there won't be anything natural on this planet anymore. The DNA of every single plant and animal will be modified. And an awful lot of familiar plants and animals won't be here anymore. You're not going to have any carnivores roving on the planet, you know. There'll be no lions and no, you know, whatnot. So, I mean,
that's so... happening soon.
Right, so that's the really challenging thing. See, once you know what heaven is like, and then once you recognize, well, if I want Earth to become like heaven, it puts a challenge into your material idealism.
Yeah, don't tell that to too many people right now.
Right. So the planet has to be managed by us, but we have to recognize as we go forward, I mean, some of these species that are dying off, or maybe are supposed to be dying off. We got to try to somehow figure this out. It'd be really handy if we had some advice and some help, you know.
We do.
If we could get Machaventa Melchizedek, you know, to come and manage these issues for us as the material sun. Because we obviously could, you know, should we spend $1 trillion trying to save this species? You know, we don't know. Are we doing something bad, making something that shouldn't die off? Or is the creative mother spirit taking her hands out from underneath that species? And so no matter how much money we spend, they're going to go extinct. How do we know? Right? These questions are in play. You know, and again, all these things. I mean, when you get to the deep enlightened life, you're not going to have desert wastelands. You're not going to have frozen wastelands. There's not going to be any glaciers, you know, anywhere. There's not going to be any polar ice caps, right? Florida won't be here. I mean, these things are all going to change.
Yeah, and will be different.
Right, and the humans will be radically different too. Right, I mean, literally, humans will be so radically different. Like they tell you, if you were to be taken to one of those worlds, they'd have to put you in a hermetically sealed bottle, because you would just be a contagion,
yeah,
biologically on the planet. Right, so natural, quote unquote. Right, just think about that. Okay, let's read one more paragraph and wrap it up here. Oh, okay.
Rather, is there a creative adaptation rather than evolution forming back? You know, no struggle, no existence. Mm-hmm. Creative adaptation just foreshadows the beauty, the harmony. Right. What do you think they mean by creative adaptation?
They mean, you know, universe is mind planned, mind made, and mind administered. Mind gives you adaptive ability. There are creative minds.
Just what we were talking about a minute ago.
Yeah, right. And it's not just minds, because mind in and of itself is just a causal sequence. You know, you plop mind on matter, you know, and you just have matter obeying the causal sequence in mind energy. You know, there's no creativity to that. Creativity is when there's a personality above that mind causality that is altering, you know, what that causal sequence is in mind, and hence what the causal sequence is, or, you know, what the sequence is going to be in matter. And so that's what they mean. There's a creative personality spirit to mind to matter phenomenon in play, you know, and rather than just being in a self-adapting sort of setting, you know, it's personality managed all of the adaptation. Okay.
Gerasim is indeed a foretaste of paradisiacal glory and grandeur, but you can never hope to gain an adequate idea of these glorious architectural worlds by any attempted description. There is so little that can be compared with aught on your world. And even then, the things of Gerasim so transcend the things of Urantia that the comparison is almost grotesque. Until you actually arrive on Gerasim, you can hardly entertain anything like a true concept of the heavenly worlds. But that is not so long a time in the future, when your coming experience on the system capital is compared with your sometime arrival on the more remote training spheres of the universe, the super universe, and of Havona.
Okay, so that's a kind of a fun little flourish to end on here. But see, again, you know, I keep stressing it over and over because they keep stressing it, you know, to try to allow most of reality to be beyond your comprehension and imagination, so that you have a future, so that you don't short-circuit yourself, to keep yourself in the deepest way possible, open to everything becoming new. Try to let go of all these preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and long-standing prejudices. Don't lock things down. There's none so blind as those who will not see. Don't be one of those who's willingly blinding yourself, short-circuiting potentials. Let go. And just let an infinite complexity begin to roll out in front of you, all of which is beyond your imagination. That shouldn't be scary. That should be exciting if you're a human.
Doesn't mean you don't imagine.
You can imagine, yes, imagine a millionfold. Mm-hmm. But never...
Close yourself
off. Keep yourself open. to the glories beyond our imagination that await us, you know? And, you know, and like they're saying at the end, in relative terms, not that long from now, right? Relative to the time it takes to get to Havona, it's going to be a blink of the eye to get to Jerusalem.
Can barely wait.
Right, so, you know, and see, right in the middle, like I said, I mean, you know, they try to get you to hold on to that there's a truth to what you're experiencing right now, but don't hold on so tightly to the facts of what you're experiencing right now. The facts are a shadow, but there is a truth that's not a shadow. The truth is not so much a downstepped expression like the facts are. You know, and if you can hold on to the truth, that will give you the joy that you desire. And then you can objectively recognize that the facts are grotesque. And that won't disrupt you. That won't leave you feeling desolate, you know, discouraged, disillusioned, despondent, you know. I mean, you can face the fact that factually things are very minimal right now. Technically, they're grotesque. Our current beauty is grotesque, factually. Take a hold of the truth that isn't grotesque. The truth is beautiful and good. The facts aren't beautiful and good. You know, and people who try to find beauty and goodness in these lowly facts, why do they fail? Why do they get so despondent, discouraged, you know, etc.? It's because they are grotesque. They're looking in the wrong place. Find the truth. And then you'll never hunger and thirst again. If that's what you're looking for.
What yeah. did you say? They hear and do not hear, or they see and do not see.
Yeah. Right. So you can see how they're constantly trying to teach us this, no matter what they're telling us about. They can be telling us about the plants and animals on Gerasim or whatever the heck they're talking about, you know, the dew point, or you know, but they're always trying to get us to shift our to eternalize our minds, to make it so it isn't just predicated on the facts of time, but it's predicated first and foremost on the truths of eternity. And then we interpret the facts of time in that context. You can begin to move towards a peace that passes all understanding if you do that. You'll never have peace if you're trying to hold on to the facts of time. The peace is only in the rigorous, beautiful, good truths of eternity. All right, let's pause here for a moment.